I gave a sermon in preparation for the Days of Unleavened Bread, and it was entitled The Joy of Salvation. And my point was that the festivals portray the plan of God, and the plan of God is a plan of salvation. Therefore, when we rejoice at the feast, what we're really ultimately rejoicing in is that salvation as well. Satan's plan, in contrast, is kind of like eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, right? It's go ahead and do what you want to do. Do it the way you want to do it, because this life don't last forever. And with evolution, there's obviously no meaning or purpose in life either. Life in Satan's plan is colorful costumes, parties, trick-or-treating in the fall. It's special music, colored lights, and Santa Claus in the winter. It's decorated basket and egg hunts and the Easter Bunny in the spring. We were headed down this last Sabbath down to Lewiston, and we went through Uniontown. And Uniontown has a little park there, and it's like one block square right in the middle of the town. The town's about four blocks square, but the park's in the middle. And we stopped to just stretch a little bit, and the entire lawn's covered with Easter eggs. I mean, eggs a foot apart, 18 inches apart, entire lawns covered with them. I mean, the bunnies went crazy. And we were looking at them. To say that there were hundreds of eggs would be easily true. I literally wondered if there weren't a few thousand eggs scattered across this yard. And the little children beginning to line up, you know, they had a time when it was going to start, and they're lining up with their little baskets. And I thought, man, bring a trash can, you know? I mean, get something. When we took trick-or-treating as kids, we carried grocery bags with handles on them. And you'd come home with like two-thirds of a grocery bag full of candy. So I can imagine be out there with kind of a sweeper or something going through those eggs, you know, getting your fair share. But the holidays are just busy work with no meaning, no ultimate purpose, no forgiveness of sin. Satan wants us to worship the creation instead of the Creator. He wants us to believe that God's way really doesn't work. And he wants us to think that our thoughts and our desires and our plans are better. See, what Satan really wants is for us to live out our entire life in Egypt. And if God brings us out, then he wants us to turn around and look over our shoulders and see if there isn't a way to get back. Satan wants to leave us in Egypt. In Exodus 3, God pulls Moses aside by appearing as a burning bush, and Moses stopped to look at it and begins to draw toward this bush to see what the sight is. And God said in verse 5 of Exodus 3, he says, "Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet. The place where you stand is holy ground." Now, when Jesus Christ in the Old Testament stopped to see Abraham before Sodom and Gomorrah was to be destroyed and had a meal with him, I don't see an account where he walked around and said, "Watch out, Abraham, don't get near me." I see him approaching him as a friend. In this case, he's wanting Moses' attention. He's telling Moses, "Listen, this is important. This is special. I want you to pay attention, and I want you to be respectful. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do." And he says, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, "I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from the land to a good and large land, a land flowing with milk and honey." To the place, and he mentions all the different groups of the people. There were various groups of people filling this land. God was going to move them aside for Israel to occupy it in their place. He says, verse 9, "Therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression by which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, I'm going to send you to Pharaoh so that you can bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." God's plan had purpose. He was fulfilling the promise that he had made to Abraham, and he was taking Israel out of captivity to the promised land. Now, Israel didn't respond to that very faithfully. And when you look back and see, Satan was always trying to draw Israel back. Come back to Egypt. Think about Egypt in a positive light. Focus on the trials and struggles ahead and turn around and return to me. These things are given to us, what? As examples. The plan of God is a plan of God calling mankind to salvation. The examples in the Bible are the examples of how the process of salvation plays out and what accountability in that respect is. Exodus 14, you begin to see Israel's response as they struggled through with some of the troubles they faced. Because as he delivered them with all the mighty miracles and all the plagues that they saw, and in verse 14 and verse number, chapter 14 and verse number 8, it says, the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, when Israel was now beginning to be delivered. And he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness, like, whoo-hoo, you know, here we go. Or as they say in the army, hoo-ah, you know, this is a big event. And so they began to move out. They were excited, but their excitement, honestly, was rather thin. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea. So now they come up behind, and Israel begins to be afraid. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. How did they cry out to God? God, save us? No, they cried out to God, what in the world have you done? They cried out to Moses. They said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? Can you imagine walking into a jail or a prison and taking the key and unlocking the door and opening the door and telling the inmates, you're free. You may leave and go as you please. And they just sit there and look at you. And you have to literally go in there and you take them by the hand and you pull them out of their cell and begin to walk them away, and they turn around and they run back in and close the door behind them. Can you imagine? But that's the process. That's what Israel here was doing. Didn't we tell you to leave us alone so that we may serve the Egyptians? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in this wilderness. Go down to chapter 16, verse number 1. This plays out again and again. God delivers Israel, and Israel becomes afraid and says, why didn't you just leave us alone? Now look what you've done. Exodus 16, verse 1, they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. So now we're out on the road, so to speak, for 30 days. It says, then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. You should have just killed us and got it over with. Why torture us this way? When we sat by the pots of meat and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. And so God gave them food to eat. Exodus 17, verse number 1. It says, then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Lord, and they camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? And so God gave them water. Exodus 32, if you go on down past the time of the covenant and the giving of the commandments, and to the point where Moses is up on the mountain with God. And again, you begin to see the attitude of the Israelites. They were always looking back to jail, to prison, to bondage. And they would have literally have had the chance to walk back in and close the door. And God is dragging them almost out into the blessing of wanting to hand to them the promised land. Exodus 32, verse number 1. It says, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. For is this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt? We don't know what has become of him. Aaron said, break off the golden earrings that are in your ears of your wives and your sons and daughters and bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears, and they brought them to Aaron. He received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool, and he made a molded calf. He said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. If it's too late to go back to Egypt, the least that we can do is we can bring Egypt along with us. We will make the gods of Egypt, and these are the ones that you will now look to and worship. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Sounds pretty good if you believe in Easter or Santa Claus or Halloween. It says, they rose early the next day, they offered burnt offerings, they brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. Eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Throw a party, have a good time, do whatever seems best in your own eyes, and attribute that to God. That's Satan's plan, and that's his purpose. See, the problem is that slavery is what Israel was used to. Slavery is what Israel did best. And God was calling them away. I pulled up a couple of articles last night trying to get some reference on prison and what happens as people come out of prison and what the return rate is back into custody. And it was interesting. In some respects, it was much higher than I expected. But it said one of the problems we're having today as they release individuals from prison, and because of the state budgets, they're actually doing early release on some of the prisoners to try to bring the cost down. But what's happening is it's almost like a turnstile because they turn right around and go back in. And they measured here, and I've got a couple different articles, but one of them said that within 3 years, 60% of the individuals who are released from prison return to the system. And another article said it was 70%. So let's just say it's a very, very high amount. This one, again, from MSNBC, just said by the end of 2008, more than 7.3 million people were either on probation, in jail or prison, or on parole. One of every 31 U.S. adults in the nation was in the system in some way. That's compared with one of every 77 adults in 1982. The numbers of people that are on parole, in prison, or on probation have doubled in this nation since 1982. That ought to tell you a little bit about social decline and what we're facing, at least in that respect. You see, that's Satan's system. Satan's system is to take us into bondage. Satan's system is to return us to Egypt. Another article that had been posted on a number of the news websites, returning to prison, nothing better to do. And it was interesting because when you read this, it can sound almost a little hard-hearted. But the person writing it here is reflecting on the relationships that she has in the prison system and the work that she does. And she says, the past few years, California has paroled around 125,000 inmates from state prisons each year. Strangely, that same number enter prison on parole violations and new terms every year. So it's 125,000 out the door, and it's 125,000 back in the door. Again, that's the revolving door of justice. So it says their reference here is that the return rate is 70%. in a period of 3 years, which means of the 125,000 people paroled last year, in two more years, over 87,000 of them will be back in prison or have already been back in a previous time, in part of that time. And she says the perpetual question is always, well, why? The hardened heart says the felons simply learn to be better criminals in prisons and shouldn't be let out in the first place. The soft heart says that they weren't given job training or substance abuse programming or basic educational skills or basic life skills, etc. And it says the argument is wide and loud. It says my answer to the question of why we keep churning the same 300,000 or so people through the prison system comes from interacting with inmates over many years, and it's fairly simple. Most of them don't have anything better to do. Sounds pretty hard, doesn't it? Says, yes, most people who come back to prison are returning to the best alternative that they have. That's a pretty dramatic way to state it, is it not? Now, there's issues there. The article goes on, addresses education and problems. But he says most people coming out of prison, for most of them, the degree of difficulty they face often convinces them that it's easier to just go back. Because when Israel looked at the desert and they looked at the risk of hunger or the risk of thirst or the risk of having to face their enemies instead of looking to God, they looked back at their bondage and they said, well, the bondage was better. Send me back there. Says, now the prisoners or those coming out of the system may not say it out loud, but it is at the heart of the matter. The saddest thing I have to admit is that for many inmates, those that I've seen, they truly are better off in prison than they would be on the streets. I've worked with homeless people on the streets. Most of those folks would be better off with regular meals, regular sleep, clean clothes, the unavailability of their drugs, which they abuse, and the medical care that is provided. Sounds really tough. Sounds tough. But is it any different than Israel wanting to go back into bondage in Egypt? Because they simply did not have the ability to look to God in that way. I thought that was a remarkable way to try to process it. It isn't so much even an indictment on where's the problem. Is the problem just the individuals? Is the problem the system? No, the problem is this is Satan's world. And his plan does not provide for forgiveness or salvation. His desire is to destroy us all. And the way he wants to do that is to keep us in Egypt. And if we escape by God's grace and his blessing, to make sure that we want to still go back, to take us back to where we've been. You ever gone back into a sin that you had already walked out of, something you struggled with, overcame, walked away from, and then later on walked back in? What process was it that took place? The book of James, James chapter 1 in this case, references where sin comes from and how it progresses and how it matures. James 1 and verse number 12, it compares someone who endures temptation and another person who does not. One person is tempted and they're drawn away, and another person is tempted and they hold fast, and it compares the one to the other. Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been proved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he's tempted, I'm tempted by God. God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt himself, anyone. Each one is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Now again, I've stated before, but so that we focus this way, Satan cannot get you to do anything you don't want to do. He can only encourage you to do what it is you already desire. And that's what it says. You're tempted when you're drawn away by our own desire. It is because we in some ways look back to Egypt or things that are wrong are still attractive to us or desirable in some way, or they offer us some kind of a respite, a rest refreshing in a way, quite frankly, that is wrong. says he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. When desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. Sin, when it's full grown, brings forth death. It says, do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good gift, every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. God's going to be there. What God is doing is right. Look to God. Do not look back to Egypt. Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. God's plan, pictured by the holy days, is the salvation, ultimately, of all of mankind, all of those who will respond to his call. 2 Peter 2 describes, again, the process of those who, having had knowledge, having had truth, having walked out of Egypt, looking back, decide to return to their former state. 2 Peter 2 and verse number 20. It says, if, after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, God opens your mind, you come out of this world and you walk away. If after you've escaped that, you are again entangled in them and overcome, which means to kind of give yourself back over to the way we were, the latter end is worse for them than the beginning. For it would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than, having known it, to turn from the holy commandment delivered to them. You know, it's like you didn't know about Sabbath, and then you learn about Sabbath, and then you begin to keep it, and then later on you begin to compromise the Sabbath, and you begin to go back the other way. You begin to be dragged back, in that sense, to the pollution that we have all been called out of. It says, to turn from the holy commandment delivered to them, it has happened to them according to the true proverb, a dog returns to his own vomit, a sow having washed to her wallowing in the mire. So it describes it as, it's, you know, be better off never to have left bondage than to escape by God's grace and then decide to go back and return. It's worse to go back. One of the books that I've used previously in regard to quitting drinking was I'll Quit Tomorrow. And it's a fair classic in that field, Vernon Johnson. I liked it because, one, I like the title, but the material is solid in terms of what he addresses. But don't you like I'll Quit Tomorrow? That's the point. You never know that tomorrow will ever come. You never know that our character tomorrow is different than it will be today. In other words, we have to be looking back at Egypt, not waiting for our opportunity to get away. But I want to read a little bit of one of the chapters. In this case, I want to read the chapter on the stages of recovery, because there's points in here that reference coming out of, in this case, bondage to alcohol. But I think there's parallel to that in terms of coming out of bondage to sin, walking out of Egypt and continuing on your way. What does it take to keep moving in the one direction and not go back? At what point do you begin to succeed? This is actually chapter 9, the stages of recovery. It says, there is visible progress during the intensive inpatient period of our treatment. One can see it in the way patients behave and in the changed attitude that it reveals. And we have names for the stages of progress toward recovery. The first stage is admission. When patients first enter the treatment unit, they are at this stage. Their very presence in the treatment setting is a significant statement in and of itself. By this act, they have accepted the reality that they're being treated for chemical dependency on alcohol. They're not being treated for gastritis or polyneuritis or even the hangovers. Somewhere on a medical chart, they have a primary diagnosis that says acute chronic alcoholism. That's the first step. I am a sinner is your first step. The second stage is called compliance. During this period, the patient's attitudes change significantly. They no longer doubt the seriousness of their condition or describe it in a weasel-worded way. They've moved to a thoroughgoing acceptance of the reality of their plight. I need help. They're able to verbalize their problems, sometimes even vehemently. I know I drink too much. You don't have to tell me, and you don't have to tell me that I need to have quit drinking either. I know that too, and I'm going to do just that. So there's a firmness of conviction that begins to form up, but that doesn't mean they're healed. That doesn't mean they're at recovery. It just means they're starting to turn the corner along the way. The third phase we call acceptance. We view achieving it as real progress. Defiant dependence is replaced by a kind of wholehearted acceptance of a personal responsibility for recovery. There is a gut-level insight on the part of the patients into the severity of their own symptoms and a healthy appreciation of the fatal nature of the disease itself. My, when I was sick when I came in here. I didn't know how sick. And I certainly didn't know how serious the disease is. Why, I could have died if they hadn't insisted on my coming for treatment. Thank God they did. Sounds like they've recovered, right? I mean, I would think, just reading, if I didn't read the rest, I'd say, well, okay, that's recovery. They're there. They know what they need to. It says, to the inexperienced counselor, such patients appear to ready to leave intensive care and enroll in our two-year outpatient program of rehabilitation. To the inexperienced counselor, the person's not there yet. Step four necessitates that there be one more thing. Mr. Kylo mentioned that one thing in terms of counseling for baptism. Do you remember when he was talking about each minister is looking for it, but maybe each will see it in a little different way? And he went to Acts chapter 2, and he showed the response to Peter's sermon, and he said they were what? They were cut to the heart. And he described that emotional response to God's call and the humbling and the acceptance of their failure and their inability to do this on their own as they go on their way. And now we were talking, in that case, obviously, in the church. It says, the experienced counselor remains wary, however, because there is a quality yet missing. For one thing, these patients are still viewing the future unrealistically. There is no way I will ever drink again, they say. The fact that the process is not yet complete is clearly seen in the heedless way such patients look to the future. We call the fourth stage surrender. Here all the welcome signs of progress from the acceptance phase are present. The Civil War is over, and the personality has drawn together again. Patients are open, self-accepting, warm. They're willing to risk human relationships. However, the final solution of the problem is still ahead. When surrender does come, it is signaled by an appropriate display of caution about the future, a more realistic perspective. I'll never drink again. No, I'm going to be careful. There's danger out there, and I'm going to prepare myself the best that I can. A realistic perspective and a respect for the enemy that we have that opposes us, obviously, in the church. There is a gut-level realization that continued help during the period ahead is going to be necessary. Patients are cheerful with the progress to date as they say, well, I'm going to go out there and I'll give it my best shot. I'm glad to know that so far more than 75% of those who have gone through this place have made it. That helps. But then they add, the 20-some percent who don't make it still scare me. As deep as I got into this illness, I know I'm still going to need help. I'm glad there's an outpatient program available to me. You better believe I'm going to stick close to AA, again, in that community. Sometimes in baptismal counseling, when I hear that bravado, that hoo-ah, you know, I read Black Hawk Down. I've been in the service. And Black Hawk Down describes Delta Force, the professional special forces. And it compared them in the book to the operation of the Rangers that were also in that operation in Somalia as well. And the Rangers would walk around making blusterous comments and hoo-ah and kind of beating their chest, ready for battle. The professional soldiers, the Delta Force, were the highest trained, and they never made such an open protest about how easy it was going to be. How many times have people charged off to war? They're going to whip up the enemy and clean up the mess in a few months, and they'll come marching home. They come home in bags. They come home to their families in pieces. So in baptismal counseling, when I hear, I'm going to obey God, I'll just do whatever it takes, I'm ready to go, I'm going, well, you know what? I don't think maybe we're to stage four quite yet. Where's the cut to the heart? Where's the emotion of, I need God, I depend on Him, and without Him, I am nothing. But I do know this, I can never, never go back. There's a process there that has to play out. Israel marched out of Egypt, what? With a high hand. You know, hooray, you know, we're marching out of Egypt. But they were also willing to go back to Egypt over and over again. Step number four is surrender, and the process of looking to God in the church, described in Acts chapter 2 as Mr. Tyler just being cut to the heart. In God's service, it isn't enough to walk out of Egypt, because we will never stay there unless we begin to consciously focus on going the other way, on the direction that leads to our salvation. Look at James chapter 1. It isn't enough to just bluster or make protest or stand up and proclaim what our intentions will be. We have to live this Christian life. You have a glass, you have to get the air out of the glass, you have to fill it with something else. Well, we are full of Satan's way and Satan's system. We are filled with Egypt until God begins to call us out of that. And the only way to replace Egypt is to replace it with, in that sense, the unleavened bread of what? Sincerity and truth. James 1 and verse 21, it says, lay aside all filthiness and overflow of wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. That meekness is part of that stage four. It's the part that leads to recovery. And be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Begin to live this way of life. That is the only way out of Egypt. It says, if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. He observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. If anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. The point being made is, if you gossip, if you speak evil, if you argue and contend, then do not tell me that God has filled you up with His righteousness and His works. Because that fruit comes out, and it describes in the Bible repeatedly, most often on our tongue. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: visit the orphans and widows in their trouble, those who do not have someone who is their guardian or protection, you know, except God. Intercede on their behalf, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Did we do that? Did we do that in the days of unleavened bread? See, the point is not, as Mr. Moody was teasing me about, I didn't raise my hand. I didn't raise my hand because Michelle left some crackers in the cupboard. I don't know. She found some crackers. The point is not, did we get through the days of unleavened bread without eating leaven? Okay? That's obviously something we need to do, but that's not the point. The point is what we did unleavened? Did we do these things? Christianity, undefiled religion, pure and undefiled religion. What part of that did we actually do? Romans 12 gives reference to what some of those things would be. And this is the proof of whether or not we're actually coming out of Egypt, or whether what we understand is more conceptual and simply plays out in our mind. Romans 12, verse 21. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Did good pour out of us during this day of unleavened bread? Verse 9, just go back, describes some of the specific things that are being referred to. It says, let love be without hypocrisy, abhor what is evil, and cling to what is good. Here's the point. Satan cannot get us to do anything that we don't want. Therefore, we have to want the evil thing that he presents to us so enticingly, or we would reject it. We have to want to respond in anger. We have to want to cheat or fudge or to cut the corner in some way. We have to want to hold back those funds and those tithes and use them instead of giving them to God as he commanded. We have to want to do something before Satan can make us do it. So it says you have to literally abhor what is evil. If it's in our mind as something that would cause us to shudder, then we certainly don't want any part of that. So that's part of the starting point, clinging to that which is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. In honor, giving preference to one another. Not lagging in diligence. Fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope. Hope of what? Well, the hope of salvation. Patient in tribulation. Continuing steadfastly in prayer. Distributing to the needs of the saints. Who did we distribute to during these days? Given to hospitality. What hospitality did we show during these days? Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. I have a problem there. That's over the top. When I look at my personal life. We were going down the road on the way Sabbath down to Kennewick with the Kylos and Michelle's in the car, and we were talking, and I don't know how it came up, but I was kind of talking a little about Mr. Keller's and his kindness and his concern, and like if there's a wolf in the sheep, he's concerned for the sheep, but he's also concerned for the wolf. He feels the wolf is not happy, and he wants that wolf to repent and be fulfilled. That's not exactly my perspective. And we said, well, we're supposed to love our enemies. I said, I do. I love them to death. I got a little way to go. But I look at these. This is a high calling. And I look at what this says. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. That's a little easier, right? You know, Jordan's in the hospital and he's got meningitis and God intervenes and heals him, and we rejoice. And Dee Dee is in the hospital effectively and dies, and we cry. And we will be crying, but for a time. So when it says that, I think that maybe is easier. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Don't you be the one that starts or maintains the problem. You be the one who sues for peace. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him a drink. For in so doing, you'll heap coals of fire on his head. Now, that's a little more satisfying, right? You know, he's gonna now have to pay. He's not going to pay us. God's his judge. It's just saying, if you treat him well and he doesn't receive it well, then you become accountable to me. God as me. And it says right here, vengeance is mine, God says, I will repay. We don't have to carry that around on our shoulders. Then, do not be overcome by evil, by these things. Overcome evil with good, with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. What do we have, brethren, that ties us back to the way we were? What do we have to cross over to get back where we came from? We don't want that, but You know, sometimes we have a little bit of a reserve, just in case. We got an escape ramp, just in case it doesn't work the way we're going. I climbed the Grand Teton, and I had some Austrian leather boots that I'd had for years, and they were kind of a treasure of mine, and I could remember the campouts and the hikes that we had in the church and where they'd been, and I put on those boots, and I climbed it, and I really didn't realize it, that they were dangerous, because the soles that are soled, that they had hardened. Rubber hardens over time. And they had hardened to the point that when you put them on a rock and the rock had a little bit of damp to it, they would skitter off the rock. They would no longer grip the rock. And they were dangerous. And yet these were something that they were kind of sentimental in some ways based on all the times I'd used them and enjoyed them. But I came off of the mountain and I thought about it and I took those boots off and I walked over and I threw them in the trash. I knew that if I kept them, I would use them again. I threw them away. And I went out and I started over. What have you got that if you hold on to it, you're going to put it back in service in a way that is dangerous to you? If your computer causes you to go back to Egypt, get rid of it. If your television causes you to stay in Egypt, get rid of it. Don't just stick it in the closet because you will use it again. If your friends are doing that, then do not maintain those relationships in that way because you will go back to be with them again. Whatever that is, do not allow Satan to offer you a path back to bondage because that's not what God has called us to. We're not to make provision for our retreat, because there is only one way God has called us to be. Romans 13 and verse number 8, owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. For the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. If there is any other commandment, all are summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. It says, and do this, knowing the time, that now is high time to awake out of sleep. For now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand, therefore let us cast off the works of darkness. Let us put on the armor of light and walk properly as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in licentiousness and lewdness, not in strife or envy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lusts. Each of us struggles somewhere in something, and some of us struggle in many things. But we need to assess what it is that is the tool that allows us to then return to where we don't want to be. And we need to restrict that. We need to remove that. We need to put it away. I put my boots in the trash can so that I would not use them and risk my life in that way. Someone told me recently, just in the last couple of weeks, so the styles now are going back toward the miniskirt. I said, really? It almost looks like I can tell. Society is going to go back and forth forever. But the fact is, brethren, let's not go there. Before society gets there, let's just pass. I remember when Megan would go out and try to find a dress for the dance or something, or they would have a prom, and you'd go out and it was hard, and this church dress code would say, well, no spaghetti straps and, you know, none of the appendages hanging out. I mean, obviously, at some point we have to say this is appropriate, this is not, and so you had to look, but that doesn't mean it wasn't there. You just had to be willing to say, well, I'm just not going back. I'm not going back there. So as society, if this is what is happening, if society is going to go back to where it was when I was a kid, and it's probably been around the loop two or three times. But if they're going back there, let's not go there. And let's not make each other say, oh, I wonder if that's a good idea or not. How about we just pass on Egypt this time? And we'll see it the next time around. We'll just skip it a while, society will come back and move the other way, and then we'll be right back. Never quite in sync, but at least ahead of the curve. God took Israel out of Egypt. He parted the Red Sea so that Israel could walk through, and then he did something else. He closed the Red Sea back up behind them so they would not return. See, we think of opening the Red Sea and Israel marches through to on their way to the Promised Land. But then God says, all right, now I'm closing off the retreat and you're not going to go back. We are going that way. When Cortez landed with his soldiers and the ships were out in the harbor, and Cortez says, well, I'll tell you what, the battle is there. He went out and he lined his soldiers up and he lit the ship on fire, the ships, and burned them in the harbor so that they could see there was no way to return except by victory. And the soldier says, well, I think we better win because that's the only option that is in our way. Brethren, we can't have any ships in the harbor. There is no plan B. We can't have an option where we turn around just in case and then I'll do this instead, because that's not what God has called us to be. 1 Corinthians 10 draws the analogy going back to Israel crossing through the Red Sea. It says, moreover, brethren, I don't want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and the sea. It was symbolic of what? What is baptism symbolic of? It is symbolic of the death of what? The old man. And so they were leaving Egypt. Israel was leaving Egypt. And that baptism symbolized leaving Egypt behind, the death of Egypt, and the resurrection and the newness of life of what Israel would do as God led them to his promise. It says they all ate the same spiritual food. They all drank the same spiritual drink. They drank the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. God wrote it and recorded it so we would not do as they did. Looking back to Egypt, looking back to sin. One of the key lessons of the days of unleavened bread, brethren, is that we only serve God by never going back, by never looking over our shoulder, by never making provision for this flesh to sin. We only serve God by looking forward in the portrayal that he gives us and with our hopes and our joys in him.